This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Humans have been so dominant on Earth in large part because of their capacity to innovate. But how does that work exactly? Why can they innovate so much? Well, that issue has been studied by Professor Min Jung from the Center of Synaptic Brain Dysfunctions at the Institute for Basic Science in South Korea. So, Professor, thanks for joining us. Welcome to you. Just tell us, first of all, you rely a lot on the concept of imagination. What is imagination?
Imagination is the process of consciously thinking about events that might happen. For example, we can imagine we walk on the moon. So you can imagine any event from what you know already. You can combine this in many different ways so that you can put together things that might happen, which can be not possible, in fact.
Yeah, and is that a uniquely human capacity? Can animals imagine?
Yeah, there is evidence for that, even in rats. Physiological studies, they stick scientists microelectrode in the brain and they record activity. And there are so-called play cells in the hippocampus where these cells fire at certain location. So while animals navigate, these play cells fire in sequence. But when they later sleep, these play cell sequences are replayed. But these trajectories sometimes cover the never experienced trajectories. So this is a quite potential evidence suggesting that these animals might imagine.
These measurements are done during sleep. And how can you know that they're imagining a new trajectory?
Because these trajectories have never been traveled by this rat before.
No, but what I'm wondering is, how do you know what they're thinking? How can you work out that that's what they're imagining?
There is a recent study where the scientists recorded this play cell activity, and while the animals are sitting quiet, it is a replay, and based on this replay, they move the virtual environment. So these animals navigate by their neural activity.
I see. Would I be right in understanding dreaming, this sort of thing happening in sleep to be a very good moment for imagination? Is that right?
During deep sleeps, these neural activities observed. They fire in rapid sequence, and they may represent what you experienced before, but as well as what you never experienced before.
Yeah. And with humans, imagining happens not just in sleep, right? It happens in the daytime too, maybe in a more sort of quiet state, but not a sleeping state.
That's right. So that's also observed in animals, in rats, while they are sitting quiet. So they navigate, they stop momentarily. During this time, these so-called replays are observed.
Okay, so then you're matching this concept of imagination with cognitive ability. Talk us through how you define cognitive ability.
Oh, it's a very broad terminology. Actually, cognitive, it is not really well defined. Cognitive scientists use as a concept against very simple stuff like seeing, moving, eating, things like that. So cognitive is somewhat not very well defined, but something like imagination, of reasoning, planning, things like that. So scientists generally categorize this as a cognitive ability.
Oh, I see. So imagination folds within cognitive ability, really. Yes, it's one
kind. Yeah, I say that. Yeah.
And then humans can have abstract thought, can't they?
So right.
Numbers, language, maybe.
Right.
And is that uniquely human?
Definitely not. Abstraction, animals can do that. But what I propose in the book is that the level of abstraction, high-level abstraction, the level is much higher in humans than, you know, other animals.
So give us examples of animals having abstract thought.
If you teach animals some rules, they can understand the rule and apply this rule to new situation. And think about it, the nature is not random. There are regularities. And animals capture this regularity as some kind of rule. And use this rule, this representation, abstract notion, to optimize their behavior. And there's, neurophysiological evidence. If you recall neural activity, many neurons are responsive to some rules or abstract concept, like numbers. For example, numerosity, that's an abstract notion, and there are neurons responsive to numerosity in the animal brain.
And there's lots of evidence that animals can count quite well, right?
Yeah, of course, definitely.
Do we know whether they can do things like add and subtract?
Yes, there is evidence for that. There's plenty of classic studies where you have to add these numbers. Give two different sets of food. So by adding these two, you have to choose. You need adding ability to be able to choose the larger quantity. And there are plenty of classic studies suggesting that animals can add numbers.
Now, one of the points you make in your book is that alongside this, cognitive ability and the differences between animals and humans and the importance of imagination, alongside all of that, you're stressing the role of memory and saying how important that is. Can you just explain that to us?
Yeah, our imagination is based on memory. We store our experiences and then use this experience, put together these pieces of experience together. So memory and imagination might be two sides of a coin, okay? So without no knowledge, we can't really imagine. We need knowledge. We need information. So by experiences, we store information, and using this information, i.e. memory, we imagine.
Does that mean, I know that we've come across this before in this series, this Henry Molaison case in 1953, a man who lost his memory due to some botched, early brain surgery.
That's right.
Just put it like this. What does he teach us about what you're saying?
This patient dramatically lost his ability to store new information, okay? So he can't really remember new experiences. And also what we now know is that if we have same damage, people with the same damage can't really have vivid imagination. So the same brain structure, i.e. hippocampus, is involved in not only remembering new things, but also in imagination.
Yes, well, that raises all sorts of difficult questions, because you're saying the hippocampus is the center of both memory and imagination, which suggests that the two of them can get mixed up, which is quite problematic if you're a lawyer or a policeman or trying to work out what's going on in a court case. And I have to say, also as a journalist, I've really come across this business of people thinking they've remembered something right when they haven't.
So
how do memory and imagination get mixed up?
So memories do change over time. So then Schechter at Harvard Psychology professor, he proposed so-called constructive memory hypothesis, meaning that we put together pieces of information according to your current knowledge and how you feel now. So memories do change over time. So if you, in certain circumstances, for example, if you are given some cues from your like trusted person, like your doctor, you know, some authority, you can form forced memories. And that's the, one chapter I wrote about to emphasize that memory and imagination might be not that different in terms of a brain, the hippocampus.
No, I find it absolutely fascinating part of your book. And I was slightly unclear still. So one might imagine that you see something, I don't know, something important like a car crash.
Yeah.
And you remember it, it sticks in the memory, it's important. And yet you're suggesting that when you come to recall it 10 years later, mm-hmm. you know, your memory of it might have changed.
Right.
Can you talk me through the mechanism by which that happens?
Because our brain, our mind tends to fill in missing information. Okay. It's been known psychologically that when we experience something, sometimes not all information is registered. There is some missing link, but our brains fill in this missing information with our best guesses. That's the way our mind operates. In that process, filling in gaps. And then because we use our best guesses, not based on actual experience, some misinformation can be slip in this process. So forced memory, this is not forced memory, but wrong information. So not exactly correct memory can be generated after you experience some event.
Right. Okay. So people filling in a detail. So let's say the policeman asks a witness, what color was the jacket of the suspect? And, maybe the eyewitness didn't really see it. And then they fill it in. Right. They imagine
yeah,
it.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
But that's different from just remembering things wrong, isn't it? I mean, I've actually mentioned this before, but it is fascinating to me that I did a story about a hijack
mm-hmm.
in 1981
mm-hmm.
and recently interviewed people who were on the plane.
Mm-hmm.
And a man was shot within 3 feet of two different individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And they remembered the incident completely differently. One of them told me the body was dragged to the front door of the plane, and the other said it was dragged to the back door of the plane. Absolutely massive difference.
Yeah.
And I mean, yeah. I know now because that it was actually the front. Yeah. So one of them was just wrong. How does that happen?
Yeah. I think we just talked about it.
Well, they're not filling in, are they? Because they both.
Yeah. That's not filling in, sometimes you. When you recall, like wrong information can get in. So it's pretty often the case that there are many witnesses. Their testimonies quite, differ, even though they saw the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So
yeah.
So what exactly is the mechanism for remembering a different way? I think so many things are involved. For example, different people pay attention to different things. So their correct perception at the time of the occurrence of the event might differ. And so different people fill in different information, maybe.
Is it also to do with sort of creating a story? Do stories come into this?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. If you think over and over, initially you don't have a full story, but it can be, details can be added on. So stories can be formed in different ways. Every time you recall, slowly new information added. That's the possibility.
Is there any evidence that some people have more accurate memories than others?
I don't know if this will be an answer, but there are a very small number of people who can really remember details of what they experienced. Okay? Super memory people. Okay. Other than that, in the normal range, probably there are some variance, but overall, the dramatic differences are not that much, I guess. Most people forget, things happened long before, right?
I don't know if you're familiar with Christopher Hitchens, the British writer who lived in America for many years. I interviewed him once, and made the point that his books had, you know, so many different references in them to other literature. Yeah, every page would have five or six quotes or different references. And he said, well, the reason that is I'm just happen to remember everything I ever read. I remember everything.
Yeah.
And it seemed the most extraordinary thing. But so have there been studies of people who have that capacity?
Yeah, also there are some people having so-called photographing memory. What I mentioned before is this is different from photographing memory. These people have a really, you know, extraordinary memory for the like entire autobiography. But there are people having a photographing memory. If you see, they can read across, you know, backward. So there are some variations, but most people, I think, normal people, we have a similar, you know, forgetting and a similar capacity.
So tell us a bit more about the hippocampus. Where is it? Is it made of the same material as the rest of the brain? Why is it so important? You know, what can you tell us about the hippocampus, which you're saying is at the center of all that you're discussing, really?
It is made of the same neurons and glial cells and the blood vessels, like any other brain parts, okay, made of neurons. Its connection is evolutionarily old, okay? And then it evolved first, and it looks like new cortical areas, new brain regions are added to the hippocampus. And it is connected to all other brain regions. It looks like it is, you know, playing the same role it's been playing long before, where it is connected with most brain regions, especially cortex, which plays a very important role in high cognitive capacity, sense information, gets information. So it gets information from all the brain region. And when we are in like during sleeping on idle state, it generates new patterns and broadcasts this to all other brain regions and it communicates. So it looks like there is a special, you know, connectivity wise, there is something special about the campus. It coordinates overall activity of the brain during like idling state.
Just talk us through the distinction between that and the cortex.
So actually, the cortex I mentioned is to be precise, a neocortex, okay? So hippocampus is also cortex, but it is evolutionarily old, so it is called archcortex. And then the neocortex, which consists of like a visual cortex, auditory cortex, motor cortex, doing many different special things, okay? Whereas hippocampus gets all this information and stores them as memories, and during idle state, generates new patterns. It's like imagination. The hippocampus seems to be important for memory and imagination, whereas neocortex, they mostly do special things.
In your book, you go on to look at various animals and to draw conclusions about their mental capacity and what it can tell us about, you know, memory, imagination, cognitive ability. And it's quite interesting because these different animals have different capacities, right? So I'm going to ask you to talk us through some of these animals and what they can teach us. So we'll start with rats, which I guess are the most frequently observed.
Many neuroscientists use rats and mice to study brain functions. So we know quite a bit about that. And the hippocampus, the rat hippocampus versus human hippocampus, very similar. So it looks like hippocampus is the basic anatomy and physiology and function seems to be conserved across rats and humans, all mammals, whereas neocortex is, you know, very different from rat versus humans. In human, neocortex is much, much more developed, the size-wise, you know, and many different specializations.
Right. Well, other animals you look at are birds, whales, bats, the Klax nutcracker, which we can talk about. But when you say the cortex in the rat is less developed, is there any of the ones I've just mentioned where the cortex is more highly developed?
No.
So, right.
So primate, yeah, cortex, especially human, cortex much, much, much more developed than other animals.
So do you think it's the combination of the hippocampus with this cortex that creates the human capacity?
That's what I propose in the book. You know, Hippocampus very similar between rats and humans, and so their memory and imagination function is similar. But because the human neocortex is expanded greatly, their abstract thinking capability is much, much higher than rats. That's why we can use abstract concept and imagine using this concept. And I think that's one major reason why we are innovative. We can come up with great ideas.
And when you come to species which are close to the human, you know, apes or some monkeys, how do they fit into this?
They are probably something in between, but there hasn't been, you know, studied much. So what we know most about, you know, imagination, neural activity related to imagination has come from rats and mice. So right now, there is virtually no data about monkey hippocampus imagination related activity. So we have to wait until the scientists come up with some data.
Yes, it's one of the striking things of your book that there are these surprisingly large gaps in what's been researched, you know.
Yeah, that's right. And I know that there are monkey neuroscientists who plan to do research on this topic. Okay, monkey hippocampus imagination.
Well, tell us about the whale, which has a bigger brain than a human, right? But less capable.
If you compare whale brain, human brain, of course, whale brain much larger. Okay, but if you count the number of neurons in the neocortex, the number of neurons in the human neocortex is more than the number of neurons in the whale brain or elephant's brain. So it looks like neocortex. There is something special about neocortex for high cognitive capacity. In a highly abstract thinking, focused reasoning, things like that.
One of the things you keep coming back to is spatial awareness and the capacity of animals to basically get from A to B and you know, with various obstacles put in the way.
That's right, yeah.
Why don't you just tell us, first of all, why you think spatial awareness, I mean, is it just because it's easy to measure that it's important, or is it more than that?
Yeah, I think that's correct because, as I told you, play cells found in the rat hippocampus is a very clear neural correlate, and then it is easy to study this spatial navigation and how hippocampal neural activity changes. That has been studied the most. And on top of that, I think the reason we, including humans, animals, are capable of imagination is because of the spatial navigation, okay? So as I propose in the book, the terrestrial animals, they have to remember trajectory, okay? Because if you go some direction, there might be obstacles. So you have to remember many different trajectories, okay? So learning all these trajectory by actual experiences, it takes too much time. So that's why I think during idling state, our hippocampus generate new patterns and evaluate this pattern. So it's like offline learning, okay? Without engaging in actual behavior, you learn by generating patterns, simulation, and imagination. That's what I propose.
Yeah. And when you get to animals like bats, you know, tiny brain, but this fantastic ability to navigate the space, right?
Much
superior to ours.
Bat is it's a rodent. It's like a rat, a flying rat, right? So if you compare a bat brain, rat brain, kind of similar. So their neocortex is not that developed compared to human, but the hippocampus is well developed, right? Rat. And they're flying. That's sort of a navigation. It's superb, as are rats.
Oh, really? I mean, see, you would say that the rat's navigation capacity is as good as a bat's?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Their navigation capacity is superb.
Okay. And then I did mention the Clacks nutcracker, which is interesting because it stores food in lots of different places and remembers where it is, which is, you know, Have you ever established that the Clacks nutcracker is like a human and that it misremembers where it's put its food sometimes?
Yeah, they sometimes misremember locations, but the scientists counted how many they recover, and the percentage-wise is pretty high. Sometimes like near 90%. So not all, it's not perfect, but they do remember many, many locations. And they compared to human, their spatial capacity and spatial memory capacity is higher because there is a ecological requirement for them to do that. Okay, they have to store and they have to retrieve. Without that capacity, they wouldn't be able to survive.
But what I'm trying to get at with some of these things is how can it be that some animals with far smaller brains than humans have greater capacities than humans in certain very specialist areas? I mean, does that help us understand what's going on?
Yeah, I think studying certain animals' brains, small brain, doing good jobs for certain thing better than humans, I think that will help us to understand how this neural network can perform computation. And even though we say small brain, if you count the number of neurons, there are many. So even though human brains is large, it's mostly neocortex, and then they are directed toward more like highly cognitive steps, like abstraction. So in case of animals, even though their brains are smaller, if you look at their neural network, the complexity is enormous, even small brain. So for certain things like remembering specific locations precisely, or certain precise motor movement control. Yeah, you can imagine that, this so-called quote unquote small network can do that.
Yeah. Much of your book is spent discussing the technicalities of measuring brain activity. You know, it's obviously a highly technical subject and specialist area. When you look to the future of the field, you're talking about these locations in the brain, the hippocampus, the cortex, neocortex, which are so important. Do you see the future of this research being in this very technical work, measuring what sort of movements of electrons and all the rest of it there are in between these areas and how they communicate and how you can show that by measurement? Is that where the future work lies?
Yeah, I think measuring neural activity is something fundamental to understanding how the brain, the neural network, operates and process information.
In what other ways do you think this field can be advanced other than measuring neural activity?
Yeah, measuring neural activity is one thing. Another is manipulating neural activity and see the behavior. Okay, so not really measuring, but activating or inhibiting certain groups of neurons and see how animal behavior changes. And also in humans, we have brain imaging. And also computational modeling, okay? So if we come up with a neural network which can, perform exactly what is required for an animal to do, yeah? So this all combination, measuring neural activity, manipulating.
Yeah, manipulating sounds interesting. When you talk about manipulating neural activity, how do you do that?
Scientists used to apply electrical stimulus. But now scientists use light stimulation. They express specific proteins in specific sets of neurons and apply light. So these proteins are engineered to be responsive to light. And they can, by applying light, they can act by specific subsets of neurons in the brain. This is called optogenetics.
It's interesting when you talk about modeling, and it suddenly opens up the possibility of a huge range of applications, doesn't it?
If it
was possible to model brain activity, how far? I mean, that would make ChatGPT look like very crude, wouldn't it? So how far advanced is that?
There has been so-called computational neuroscience. It's a big field. A lot of progress is going on, but now what we achieved with so-called deep learning AI, that's not truly biological. So truly biological, and at the same time, you have like, the current AI, like deep learning, they put many, many, many layers, much more than in humans. And not, they don't really use a real biological algorithm, and they can achieve stunning success. So the current computational science, if they advance and they can come up with ways to together this realistic neural network, and then come up with ways to have them perform better than like current deep learning algorithm, I think that will happen in the future.
Can I just ask you one final thought about how this is all funded? I mean, this is such deep research, and at this stage, it's not obvious that it has applications that are profitable, you know, that companies can use. So how does this get funded? Who is paying for this work to go on?
The government fund is one source, like in the United States, NIH, National Science Foundation, and also some private foundation like Howard Hughes Medical Institute, just like that.
And when they fund it, what are they hoping to achieve? What's the, you know, is there a goal that funders have in mind?
Yeah, that's their goal is, advancement of knowledge. And that will eventually lead, for example, in case of NIH, we have to understand the brain to come up with a way to cure mental diseases, okay? So without understanding the brain, we can't really, find good cure for many psychiatric illnesses, okay? So basic research is needed. That's why National Institute of Health, United States, support this kind of research. And also National Science Foundation, also some private foundation, and even some military fund, they do support this basic research.
Yes, I thought the military... might be involved somewhere, but yeah. So that's a very interesting thing you've just said. I mean, is there anything in your work that's made you think, or what you've read and research you've seen, that we're closer to, let's say, a treatment for depression, let's say, a very common ailment, you know, and which affects millions of people? Is the kind of work you're discussing helping us understand that, or is it still too far away to say that?
There is so-called rumination in depression. These depressed patients tend to think about, things, the aversive event over and over, okay? This is sort of imagination. You imagine things that are bad again and again. So there might be, some mechanism go awry in, your imagination process towards something negative. And then, that's maybe one link I can think of. But overall, what I proposed, what I wrote in the book, is not directly related to mental diseases.
No, I know, but I was just trying to think where this research that you're so involved in may lead. Yeah. And it's got so many possibilities, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, Professor, thank you so much for discussing this very interesting and difficult area, very early in a way, isn't it? But which holds so much potential.
Yes, actually the motivation for me to write this book is I think time is right to think about these subjects. Neuroscience so far focused on like sensory processing, motor control, memory, but not much about like a spontaneous cognition, imagination, creativity, innovation, this kind of stuff. But I think it is now possible to study this subject. So I'd like to encourage young scientists to get into this field.
Well, I'm sure you've helped them do that. Thank you very much, Professor Min Jung.
Thank you for your kind invitation.